Did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? And they found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients to create gummies, baked goods, and flower for whatever type of buzz you'd want. I'm talking about Mood.com. They have an incredible line of cannabis gummies, and you get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. This isn't some rinky-dink discount of 5 or 10%. This is 20% off your first order. Forget one-size-fits-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. My favorite are the Sleepy Time Advanced gummies. That's right, those are for sleepy time. You know when you just can't fall asleep? Take these and they'll put you right in the mood. Beyond gummies, Mood also has a selection of flower, pre-rolls, bakery treats, and beverages. Listen, you can find gummies to just get you high pretty much everywhere these days. But Mood's functional gummies combine premium, federally legal THC with targeted botanicals to help you get into the perfect mood, usually in as little as 15 minutes. And everything ships discreetly right to your door. No dispensary lines, no awkward conversations, just better days and nights delivered to your doorstep. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. So head to Mood.com, find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code SPECIALISTS when you check out to save 20% on your first order. Try it today at mood.com.
Movie Buff Specialists Phil and John are back as we continue counting down our favorite 100 movies of all time. We are at number 55 tonight, and we are talking about The Last Picture Show, which is in fact a movie, and Fantasia, which is not a movie. I don't care what anybody says. It has no plot. But anyway, we're here to talk about The Last Picture Show and Fantasia. John and his music. I can't wait to talk about Fantasia. I will say, I think this is the first time I've ever actually fully watched Fantasia. I think I've seen all like the clips at various times throughout my life, but I don't think I ever actually sat down and watched it. And I will tell you this, at 2 hours, that was unexpected. That was very, very unexpected. But anyway,
I mean, I love Fantasia. I'm looking forward to talking about it from like my music background and like talking about the importance of it there. And The Last Picture Show, I had to watch twice to see if I really liked it or not. And I did like it better on a second watch, but we're going to be talking a lot about Keith's tonight as well.
Yeah, and The Last Picture Show is a very American movie. Fantasia is a very of the time movie. So these are two very particular films. Like, I think that The Last Picture Show is one of the best put together movies in the history of film in terms of from directing, acting, screenplay. To me, it's just one of the best put together. The fact of using no score, no color, all that fun stuff. But it's kind of like when you sit down and you watch a movie that might be considered the best Russian movie of all time. If it's very Russian and I'm American and I've never lived in Russia, it's not going to connect with me. The Last Picture Show is 100% just an all-out American movie. Like, this movie does not work anywhere else because of what it's dealing with high school football and these relationships in this small town and like people just not moving on and everybody knowing who's sleeping with everybody, but in such a dark, depressing way in one of those small Texas towns that don't matter. And then Fantasia, you have a movie that in 1940 was very groundbreaking. And now it's just kind of like, okay, why is the guy talking to us in between each thing? Like, why can't we just watch the pictures? Like, so it's very funny. These are two very, very, very specific movies to what they are. And it's going to be a fun one to talk about. Jordan Alford does not like either of them, and he struggled to like any of the characters in The Last Picture Show, which is something that I will argue with for the next 30 minutes. So, John, let's start with the last picture show. You look like you're already about to burst. And since it's my movie, I'm supposed to go first, but you watched it twice in 3 days or whatever the hell it is.
I watched it twice in 2 days.
So just
go. I watched it yesterday. I watched it today. But on my first viewing, I absolutely agreed with what Jordan's saying. I couldn't connect to any of the characters for some reason. And maybe that is like me being Canadian and not connecting to the like Americana of the film. Mm-hmm. But on a second watch, when I was more prepared for it, when I had a better idea of what to expect and what to look out for, I did appreciate it a lot more. Despite the fact that I still appreciated it on a first watch, because it is a very artistic film and there are a lot of very fantastic decisions made with cinematography. And like you said, like the lack of score and direction and all that, there's some very, very good decisions made with it. But I just found it so hard to connect to the characters that until I watched it the second time and started picking up on the symbolism in the film and see the layers kind of further down in the characters, mm-hmm. that I could truly appreciate it.
Yeah, and so what I say is this movie isn't – so each of these characters is actually a piece of the town. And I think that's what I love so much about this. None of the characters really matter.
Mm-hmm.
They are all versions of this town. Yep. The youth of Sonny and whatever Jeff Bridges' name is. I don't know why I'm drawing a blank. Dwayne, thank you. Yeah, and JC and all them. They are going nowhere. Mm-hmm. Just like this town is going nowhere. They are failures of their predecessors. This town is a failure of those keeping it there. JC is turning exactly into her mother, which we see Ellen Bernstein's character in this movie is the wildness that this town used to present that no longer exists in any way, shape, or form. And we see her cutting it out and trying to get back to it, and her daughter trying to find her way there in a place that is just pushing back against it the entire time. Mm-hmm. You have Sam the Lion, who is just one of my favorites. I love Ben Johnson in this movie. One of my favorite characters in any movie. He is the idea of this town. It is that this could be something more important. We're holding it together. It's stoic. It's something that in America, we look at towns like this and we're like, oh, that's interesting. That's cool. Like the ghost towns, let's drive through it. People lived there. That wasn't a ghost town until it became a ghost town. You know, like, and that's what Ben Johnson is doing here. Obviously, Billy, who's sweeping the whole movie, he is very much the innocence of this town just being completely flushed down the drain. That one's not really hard to see. And then Cloris Leachman's character, who she absolutely earned this Oscar because some of the most haunting scenes from this movie involve her, even though she barely does anything. It's this idea of looking for the past and looking for what's mm-hmm. better for you and what you think is going to make you happy, and realizing it's just going to be just as painful no matter what. It does not matter. But coming to terms with that, and the ending of this movie is so important, where it's never you mind, never you mind. It's just this, I forgive you. We are just products of this place. And I think that's what's so important. It doesn't matter. We don't care about, like, yes, you're supposed to care about the characters, but these characters are just different representations of the flaws of this town, and they're just being personified. That's all it is. And what drives home for me in this movie, and I'm not from the middle of nowhere, Texas, but small town New Jersey, which small town still had like 20,000 people, 18,000 people, whatever it is, but it was a township, so it was really three towns. But still this whole idea of like the football team got the credit for nonsense, like nobody actually cared, and like all that. And I could see so much of everybody knew who was sleeping with everybody. I worked at a pool company, and my boss grew up in the town that he was now running his business out of. He knew everybody's parents. When you would mention, you know, we go out, you know, all of us, we're going out drinking when we're 20, 21. And then we come to work the next day and we tell him, he's like, oh, you're out with that person's daughter. I went to school with them and they did the blah, blah. And you're just sitting there and you're like, holy shit. Like, it's so realistic to me. And to not put a score, to not put any color in this movie, it is one of the bleakest American masterpieces ever. This is reserved for Bergman. Like, this is reserved for Europeans who are deeper thinking. And Peter Bogdanovich makes just one of the bleakest American movies to ever exist.
Absolutely. And it's that lack of color and that lack of score that really, it makes the film feel so real. And like, that's the big thing that really impressed me the most with it on the first viewing was, by without having that score, with only having the 50s music playing in the background and having like the diegetic music at be the score for the film, it really puts you into this film and it makes you feel like you're with these characters. And where I can relate with these characters, I did live in a town of 2,000 people. Like, I've lived in a small community where you know absolutely everything that is happening in that town at all times. Yeah, it's Canada, and we're not talking about the football team because we don't have them. Mm-hmm. But every other aspect of this film happens in a small community. It does hit really close to home, having experienced something like this.
Yeah, and it's that ability that you can't get away from it. No matter where you turn, you're constantly stuck and surrounded by all of this that's going on. There's nothing you can do about it. I mean, I love at the beginning of the movie the whole thing about tackling. Mm-hmm. That's all he hears. He's run into four different people in this deserted-ass town, and all he hears about is tackling. And it's so unimportant, but in this town, it's so important. There's no conversation about it doesn't matter if you're not good at that. You'll be good at the books. You'll do stuff. Mm-hmm. You don't like you go and you work manual labor after that. Like, that's it. That's what this town. You either do that or you get the pool hall. That's it. There's nothing else to do. It's just a dying town. And it's a bunch of people who don't know how to move on. I always love the scene where Sonny is driving out and he's putting it down to the floor, pedal to the metal. He's driving, and then he comes to that realization of where the hell am I going to go? There's nowhere to go. It's that hopeless feeling of, even if I left here, is my life really going to be any better? How am I going to make my life any better? You're not. You can't make your life any better. Like, you're stuck in the situation, and you get the people from Wichita Falls who keep coming in. Oh, we're going to do, you know, Randy Quaid's character and these people who are helping Cybill Shepherd go through her sexual awakening. All of that. It's like rich and wealth and all these things. We don't really get to know what those people are doing. We just know that they're better off than the people that we're following around. All these people have are the stories that they tell each other about each other. The legend of Sam the Lion. Anywhere that isn't this town, Sam the Lion doesn't mean a thing. He doesn't matter. But in this town, he's a larger than life figure. I love his scene where he's talking about Ellen Bernstein's character and how they used to go out and she was wild and all that. And it's like, that's what he's holding on to. There's nothing else. It's the only time in the movie you actually see him smile. Other than that, he's always got the stoic face. And it's just the memory. And it's what keeps them all there and what prevents them all from leaving.
Yeah, and it's set up really well in that opening scene where we do have the townspeople just talking about too bad they can't tackle. Because it really demonstrates how much this town dwells on the past. And it really goes to show like this theme of like this lack of modernity in the town. And like the reason that it's called the Last Picture Show is because we're getting to a point where the modern era just doesn't exist in this town anymore because the town can't move past what's already happening in the town. It still has a pool hall. That's the place where people are going. The movie theater can't keep up. And it's just nailed home through that bleakness in the film and the fact that the characters all try to get away, but they all come back.
Yeah. And I think, like, if you look at the set design of this movie, everything is filthy. Everything is bare. It's empty. There's no excitement to anything that's going on in the houses. Cloris Leachman's house is as bland as it gets. You know, when they're at the dance, everything is so bland. Such a depressing scene that's just thrown in for a second is Sonny running into his father and they have a 3-sentence interaction. And then that's the last time we see his father, the whole movie, just brutal. I'm laughing because it's so brilliant. But like, if you look at the set design, if you look at every time they're in the pool hall with the dirt on the windows, they couldn't possibly clean it off, but that's still where everybody goes. This dumpy old place. We had a place in my town called Caffrey's that ended up burning down, and then they brought it back, and now it's too clean and pristine. But you could, like, there was literally grease on everything, but that's where everyone went. If you went there, mm-hmm. you know, now that it's Christmas time, this is when I'd always go home from work or whatever. Go home on a Tuesday during December, and you'd have like 12 old men just sitting at the bar drinking beers at 11 o'clock in the morning. It didn't matter. And that's like, it's this small town, rural, beat up, like, we work hard and we don't care about cleaning everything up. I mean, all they do is eat cheeseburgers that I always love when she opens up the refrigerator and pulls it out. It's like, yeah, this isn't some mass plant of meat or something like that. Like, they literally have like enough cheese. If they run out of cheeseburgers, they're out of cheeseburgers. Like, that's it. There's no crazy storage system or anything like that. It's just the refrigerator with it. And, you know, I like the dynamic between the coach and Sonny, the coach never really admitting that he knows what's going on, even though everybody in the town knows what's going on. It's all these, like, you just, it's all so bland and it's all seemingly so unimportant, but to these people, it's literally all they have. And that's why every time I watch this movie, it just devastates me, because we see JC trying so hard to make something more of herself, to become something else. Cause if she, mm-hmm. I mean, she lived in LA, she'd still be incredibly attractive. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't matter, but you know, Dwayne's like, oh, I'm going to marry her. That's like, that's all they're thinking about. There is no other future. There is no real future. And then JC's going to be just like her mother, who settled down with somebody that she doesn't even care about. And she's just going through the motions. Like, all of that, it all adds to just this setting and this town that just is unrelenting to every single person in it, because there's no escaping it.
Yeah, and even when, and like we said, even when they do try, I mean, when JC and Sonny run off together to get married, like, they're brought back to the town. Like,
and she wants to be brought back.
Right? Yeah, she wants to, because she left the note in the first place, right? Like, yep. There's this security in this small town for the people there. And like, it's what you see in small towns. Like, you talked as someone who taught in a very small community, all you want to see for these teenagers growing up is for them to reach out and go out and explore the world and experience the world. But they're so scared to do it because of how isolated they are and how tight-knit their community is, that when they do, they almost all inevitably come back in the end anyways.
Well, and if you think about it, what is nobody doing in this movie? Nobody's complimenting anybody. Mm-hmm. Everything is a takedown the entire movie. The only person that anybody builds up is Sam the Lion. He's the only one. And that's because they almost look at him as like an oracle of this town. Like, he has all the answers. He can do no wrong. That's who they're worried about. That's the only one that they comment. Everybody else is a shitty person as far as they're concerned, mm-hmm. or they're going to end up amounting to nothing. And that's just basic psychology. When you're told over and over again that you're going to amount to nothing, you will amount to nothing, because you start to believe that you're going to amount to nothing. And all these old men in the town who, you know, they never amounted to anything. They don't want the kids to amount to anything. So they dwell on the fact that they suck at football, that, you know, everything is falling apart, all of this. And this is really told at the end of the movie when the guy runs over Billy and Billy's dead in the middle of the road, and they're blaming him for sweeping the street. Why were you sweeping the street? Why is he in the middle of the road? I don't understand. What's he doing? And it's like, they are even blaming the youth when they just killed the youth. Mm-hmm. It's just this crazy psychological experiment. And I don't know how Bogdanovich captures it so well, because so many movies like this are tried to be made. I think of one that I really didn't like, which was Winter's Bone, the Jennifer Lawrence movie, mm-hmm. with John Hawks, the one that really put Jennifer Lawrence on the map. I don't like that movie, but it's a very similar vibe. But then this also gets away with it without having to go the David Lynch Twin Peaks Blue Velvet route. Like, this stays unbelievably realistic, almost to a fault. It stays so realistic that that's probably what turns a lot of people off from it, because Sonny doesn't have any bigger dream. Dwayne doesn't have a bigger dream. JC doesn't have a bigger dream. None of these people are striving to be something. And so often in movies, you need that. A movie that's very similar to this, about kind of just being lost in a small town, which is on my list, is Breaking Away. But they all want to be, like, at least the main character in Breaking Away really wants to be something. Mm-hmm. And that is not the case for anyone here. They are aimless. They have no idea what to do. But there's something so captivating about that, because what do you do when you have literally no direction and you have no hope of finding?
Yeah. I mean, I do think that is a reason why people, this film might be turned off from this film, is because without that ambition, it's so hard to relate to these characters. Mm-hmm. And without direction for them, because it's not even like we see role models for these characters. And something completely absent from the film is, like, other than Sam the Lion, who is literally just like the person kind of holding this town together, we don't spend a lot of time with adult characters for these mm-hmm. teenagers, these adolescents, to look towards and to strive to being. And it does create this air of emptiness in the film. Mm-hmm. It just feels like something's missing because of it. And despite the fact that some of these characters are interesting, I will say this, JC's by far the most interesting character in this entire movie.
And oh yeah, and Cybill Shepherd should have, like, she should have became a star after this movie, and she really didn't.
And her journey throughout it, of starting the film as this, like, straight and narrow, very Christian young girl who mm-hmm. thinks sex is a sin and, like, doesn't want to have sex until marriage, to having her mother be like, no, have sex so you realize how bad life is.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, like, we get her sexual awakening throughout the film. It's just such a fascinating journey, framed in a way where it's like, sometimes in films when a female character is being that promiscuous in a film with, like, an ensemble cast, they aren't presented in a very positive light. But JC's character is always presented in a positive mm-hmm. light in this film. And it's just a fascinating way of approaching the topic of budding sexuality that isn't usually utilized in other films.
Yeah, and it's going through her. Like, we don't really care about Dwayne and Sonny's obviously being... they're dwelling on this with him and Cloris Leachman's character. But, like, Dwayne, we don't care. Like, this is very much her movie. But the thing that I find interesting about this is that doesn't mean that I think by any means JC is the main character of this movie. She becomes, like, the second most important character of this movie, but she's not presented that way. And what I love about this, and I know you talked about slow cinema because you watch Satin Tango or however you pronounce it. But I think this movie is very influential to slow cinema mm-hmm. because of the way that it unfolds. This movie is under 2 hours long, barely, but it is under 2 hours.
Sure doesn't feel like it.
but I agree. I think it feels longer in a good way for me. But when you watch this movie, it starts off with Sonny and Dwayne and Billy, and then Sam the Lion. And then it works its way through all of the characters, but it doesn't have one of those moments where, oh, now we got to get everybody in here. No, it has everybody come in, whenever everybody just is. They're just existing. Yeah. I think the first time we see Cybill Shepherd might be when she's in the classroom. I don't actually remember that, but it might be when she's in the classroom. They're not giving these massive moments to each main character. Oh, no, it's not. It's in the movie theater when she turns around and says, what are y'all doing back here sitting in the dark? Such a great shot, such a great moment, but it just allows them, it lets you know she's important because of the camera shot there. It lets you know what's going to be, like, Ellen Bernstein's character when she comes in and it's, hey, your mom is coming, you better hurry up, and how quickly they all move around and sit in the right positions, and then she's got the glasses on and she pulls them down. It tells you everything you need to know about that character, and she still gets enough time to end up getting an Oscar nomination for it. That's how much like it's able to build it. Cloris Leachman's character doesn't come in the movie till almost 35, 40 minutes in. She wins the Oscar for the movie. Like, it just allows, again, and this is why I think it's important with the characters. The characters aren't driving this movie. No. The town is driving this movie. And the way that Bogdanovich presents it, he's allowing the town to tell the story that the town needs to tell, in the order the town needs to tell it. He's not forcing characters in. There's long stretches without Sonny. There's very long stretches without Dwayne. But you still remember that they're there, because at the end of the day, you're thinking about, who's JC screwing over? Who is Sonny screwing over? Who is Randy Quaid's character kind of screwing in this situation? Who's being left behind? I mean, the shot of Cloris Leachman sitting on the bed after she was all excited, making up the nice dress and everything, and he doesn't show up. Haunting. It's 3 seconds long, and it's absolutely devastating. I just think it's so powerful. And it does such a good job of getting into every single one of these characters, whether you like them or not. It gets into what each one of them is ultimately struggling with. And I think that's just what sets this one apart from other movies that try to be like it.
It's interesting because, like, well, we have a lot of movies that are character-driven or plot-driven. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the biggest thematically-driven films mm-hmm. that we've discussed so far. And it is those themes of like stagnation and rejection mm-hmm. of modernity. And I honestly think the most important scene in this entire movie is the English classroom where they're talking about Keith's poetry. Mm-hmm. Because it completely lays out the theme of this movie. And it requires a little bit of like understanding of Keith's poetry and everything like that. Because they mention Ode to a Nightingale, and then the line the teacher reads isn't from Ode to a Nightingale. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's from a different Keats poem. And they're kind of talking about this idea of like becoming immortal and immortalization. And the way the town approaches the idea of immortality is that stagnation. And it's mm-hmm. kind of like keeping things the same, always. Yeah. And then that way, nothing goes by, everything's the same, easy to go with. But Ode to a Nightingale isn't really about that, because it's more this question of like the pain of living through life and being mortal versus the yeah. permanence of death. And that's really what the major theme in this movie is that this stagnation is the equivalent of death, but these characters are still going through all the pain of being mortal.
Well, and that's the thing. This stagnation is like death, but it's also what's keeping the town alive. Because yeah. if people stopped being stagnant, then the town wouldn't exist. However, if they continue to be stagnant, the town's going to die anyway. And if they move on, the town's going to die. So it's mm-hmm. like you're like this town, which is a living, breathing thing at this point. There's nothing you can do. And the tagline for this movie is literally Anarene, Texas, 1951. Nothing much has changed. ... That's it. That's what the tagline for the movie is. Like,
no.
And now the things that are changing are bad. At the end of this movie, after the last picture show happens, and they have to close it down because she couldn't possibly do it, she doesn't know what she's doing, and Sam the Lion was taking care of everything, and that's it. They don't even have a movie theater now.
No.
We still don't get an answer to, okay, what is Sonny going to do? What's JC going to do? What is Dwayne going to do? We don't get an answer. I mean, obviously, Dwayne's going off to the military.
Korea.
But going to Korea. Not probably a good thing for him. But what else are they going to do? We don't get the actual answer. It's still very much left with, like, you know, we have to try to move on. But what do we do? You know, and how do you keep living when there's nothing enjoyable in life? And I think that's... Mm-hmm. You know, you think about all of the high school stuff in this, that high school football game is jam-packed. Nothing else in this movie is jam-packed. The movie theater is not jam-packed. The diner every now and then will have people in it, but it's nothing super, super crazy. It's all empty. It's all isolated. It's just this miserable, miserable place. And it's a hard thing to make a movie about, yeah. about a town where nothing good is happening and still end it where nothing good happens. But what I give Bogdanovich so much credit for is, these towns exist all over the world. And being that we live in America, which is, you know, one of the richest nations in the world, if not the richest, I don't keep up with that all that much. But with, you know, the land of opportunity, there are still places here where there is literally no opportunity, where you have no chance just because you were born there. And this movie does such a good job of addressing that. Dwayne and Sonny have so much confidence in their town. Sonny, not as much as Dwayne, but they have confidence. Once they leave that town, they don't even know what the hell's going on. They just don't know who they are.
Well, and it's even exemplified by the fact that they go to Mexico for those couple of days, yep. and everything changes while they're gone.
Yep. Almost like if you leave, it's okay, now the sickness pervades. You didn't give me the antibiotic for 4 days, and Sam the Lion dies, and nobody really knows what to do.
Yeah. And in the end, I think the conclusion of where we get with Sonny and Dwayne's characters is really important, because we have Dwayne going off to the military, which is really the only escape from this monotony in these small towns that a lot of people mm-hmm. get.
Yeah.
Because
it opens up opportunities. You see the world.
Exactly. And in the end, when we're looking at these small towns, I mean, maybe it's different in the States, but here in small communities, you're not getting a prime education at a small school with
it is not different 100 in the kids. States.
So if you think about that and the opportunities about it, then yes, you could be the JC in a situation where you do get to go off to Dallas and go to university. But more often than not, you end up a Dwayne or a Sonny. You either get stuck in the town running the pool hall while also working the oil wells, mm-hmm. or having to join the military just so you can get out.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And I see that a lot. I mean, yeah, I'm in a town that's very heavily, you know, a lot of people will go military or, you know, mm-hmm. the community college route, whatever it is, and then work in the town. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, small towns are meant to be able to survive off of the people in yes. the town. I mean, there is something cool about when you go into one of these small towns, everybody still knows what's going on with everybody. I mean, it's a very different mm-hmm. way. I mean, my fiance's from, you know, Denver and Phoenix and all this different stuff. And I lived in this small town, and like, she always laughs when we're like, oh yeah, just name dropping whoever. And it's like, how do you like, why do you know who these people are? Because we were so involved with it. You can't not be involved with it, because everybody's just in each other's business. And, you know, there's something endearing about that. There's also something terrifying about it when it starts mm-hmm. to go sour, because there's no way to stop the atrophy. It's just going to keep bleeding out, and there's nothing you can do to prevent it.
Yeah. It's honestly, it's one of those things in retrospect, having lived in one of these communities, they're somewhat welcoming and they're somewhat very terrifying at the same time.
Yeah, they are. They really are. They really, really are. There's something, and this is maybe the wrong word, but there's something very incestuous about them, where it's like mm-hmm. everything that happens is happening within it. And it's all, yep. it's, there's no outside. There's no outside. And when Randy Quaid comes in, that changes the whole movie. When it Randy does. Quaid comes yep. into the movie, that changes everything. Everybody still knows who he is. But that moment, because he's not from Anarene, that changes everything.
Yep.
And the rest of the movie, there's no hope for anybody after that. Mm-hmm. I just want to throw this out there real quick. Ben Johnson wins Best Supporting Actor, beat Jeff Bridges. Cloris Leachman won Best Supporting Actress, beat Ellen Bernstein. And then Picture Director, Screenplay, Cinematography, it lost all of those. I think it should have won Cinematography. Picture, that was a crazy year, because it had The French Connection, and it had The Last Picture Show, and it had A Clockwork Orange. So I can't really argue too much on that one. But I just wanted to throw out there, like, kind of what it was nominated for, what it won. Cause I just think it's a master class of acting. Like, it's just ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it should have won Screenplay over The French Connection, but that also, it was The French Connection, A Clockwork Orange, and The Last Picture Show were all nominated for that adapted screenplay. That's pretty unfair. And also, what is The Last Picture Show based on? Because I'd love to read it and just see what a nightmare it really is, because I'm sure in book form it's even more depressing. All right, John, anyway, let's get away from that and get on to things that are a little bit happier. But first, what was the best thing you watched this week? Actually, go ahead. I gotta go get water.
Okay, well, this week I watched quite a few things this week. I'm still catching up. I'm definitely on track to finally finish a movie a day for the end of the year, so that's looking good. I saw a few things, much to the chagrin of some of our listeners. I did go see the new Spider-Man movie, and it was fun. It had that fan service that was nice to watch and see, but man, if we're talking about it as a movie, it really did not land well. It sees a lot of, it's great seeing, you know, these classic characters we've seen over the last 20 years on screen again, altogether, but man, give us some character development that sticks through an entire film, please, Marvel.
I didn't even need to hear. I missed the whole beginning of that. You didn't even have to say Marvel. I knew you were talking about Spider-Man.
Yeah, but wasn't great. But I did go see Spielberg's West Side Story remake, and that surprised me completely. I mean, it's no surprise to any of our listeners that Spielberg hasn't made a good movie in a while, for in our opinions. But I mean, you take a classic American film, something that has no right being remade because it's considered one of the greatest American films ever being made. It has a memorable story that everyone knows, and somehow you manage to make it relatable in a modern day where it's more easily accessible. I know I've talked to people who watched the original 61 film and say, okay, but this movie sucks. Mm-hmm. And you're like, okay, let's talk about why this movie doesn't suck. But West Side Story does a fantastic job of recapturing that fire from the 61 version. Spielberg's mm-hmm. direction is really great. The choreography is phenomenal. The vocals are better in this version. I'll go straight out and say it. The decision to replace Doc's character with Valentina helps really lay more into like the ethnic disparity between the Sharks and the Jets and the Caucasian and Puerto Rican communities in the West Side. And it honestly shocked me that a remake of such a classic film could be this good.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. You know, obviously I haven't seen it yet and Spielberg hasn't been doing it for me of late. So I'm glad to hear that it's, you know, that you enjoyed it a lot because I know you're a huge fan of the original one. So that mm-hmm. is a, that's a big deal. That's a big deal coming from you. Cause you could have easily just said this sucked and moved on from there.
Yeah. So it definitely did not. It's worth a watch. If you haven't, I know it didn't blow the box office out of the water at all.
No, in fact, it did terribly. Yeah.
But it honestly is so worth a watch. And I'm just so happy a new generation gets to experience West Side Story for the first time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, hopefully they go experience the original one too, because that would be cool. Yes. I had a shit week. I had a couple 3-star movies, but that was the best I did. And I'm going to go and I'm getting towards the end of Ghibli. I really thought that I was going to like When Marnie Was There and The Tale of the Princess Kaguya a lot more. They both came in at like 3 stars. You know, they're good. They have their flaws for sure. You know, and I only have one left and that's Earwig and the Witch. And I sure can't wait for that. I've been trying to find another classic Christmas movie, one that I haven't necessarily seen before. Struggling. Scrooge didn't do it for me. Miracle on 34th Street didn't do it for me. The new Grinch didn't do it for me. I'm struggling. Christmas Chronicles didn't do it for me. Anyway, so I'll just go with the movie I watched today, which was Bugsy. Warren Beatty's hit or miss in this movie. He has some moments of like really amazing when he's being a charismatic womanizing prick. He's great. You know, is he acting? I don't know. But the one part that he can't do is when he's going like crazy and like trying to be intimidating. It doesn't really work. But Annette Bening in one of her first great roles, she's amazing. And Ben Kingsley, damn man. Like Ben Kingsley is just a hell of an actor. He plays Meyer Lansky in this, top notch, amazing. Loved him. Should have won the Oscar. Didn't, you know, that's how it goes so often, but, it was good. It was good. It wasn't great, but it was good. And, you know, it's cool to see Warren Beatty, even though he's older in this, it's good to see him older and still hitting it because, you know, he had his moments with Bonnie and Clyde and all that. And then through the 70s and 80s, and he kind of, I mean, now since really Bugsy, he really hasn't done much. But it was good to see like when he was kind of still in control of everything. It's not up there with like the best of the gangster genre, and it's a tough genre to be a part of, but it's good. And unfortunately, that was the best thing I watched this week. So that's what I got.
Well, hopefully this week will yield better watching for you.
I really hope so, man. I went to a library. I don't know if anybody's still heard of those. And I picked up 7 movies, so it's got to be better, right? Bugsy was one of them. So I'm finally going to get through these Oscar Best Picture winners and these Best Picture nominees that I haven't seen that are on no streaming services that I don't feel like paying for. So instead, I get like this broken, half broken case for Bugsy, which like doesn't even close all the way, you know. But hey, that's the library, man. I'm all about it. I'm a big fan. So, John, tell me about music pictures.
So, Fantasia is such a It's my second favorite Disney movie of all time. And no, not wrong. Completely right. And it's funny because the first time I watched Fantasia, I absolutely hated it. Mm-hmm. Granted, I was like 8 years old. I'm watching this movie. I don't have an appreciation for the music in the film. I don't have appreciation for like a movie without a plot.
Yeah.
But as I've grown older and as I've grown more mature and studied music at university, I have a very, very deep connection with Fantasia and just what it represents. I love that Disney decided to go in this experimental route to create this symphonic piece showing the relationship between image and music. Mm-hmm. It's something that as a music student, you do a lot. There is a lot of music visualization that you do going through music programs and growing up in bands and everything. And to see Disney take that and take animators without who are not classically trained in music and just have them, hey, here's a piece, draw it. It's a fascinating experiment that unfortunately didn't work for Disney. The original plan was to produce a Fantasia film every 10 years and kind of introduce children to classical music and introduce them into a way of experiencing music that they probably weren't doing. And it's so unfortunate that it didn't pay off because it's so good. And there are some aspects of it where it's like, okay, this is an interesting piece that you've chosen here. But in the end, the images and the way they work with the sound is absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah, so Jordan literally said what I think down here. It's a pivotal movie in the development of animation and music and film, but I just didn't care. And I guess my biggest problem is, and John, obviously, you're a massive music nerd. Like, there's no denying that. You love, you know, you love this. You said you were a student with it and all that. So, like, you love this stuff. For me, it's what I have to put myself in the shoes of, and I have our time with, is this is 1940.
Mm-hmm.
The first movie that even had animation in it, feature length, was in 1937.
Yep.
The first movie that had dialogue in it was 1927. Films with speaking parts were 13 years old at this point. Feature length animation was 3 years old at this point. And so how do I put myself in the shoes of 81 years ago and just how monumental this really was? Because it is a monumental achievement to do this. To mm-hmm. integrate live action with animation, to have the music and you know, pretty much create life to musical notes, to create visual life. It's unbelievable. Like, I agree with all that. I need, if I'm watching a movie, mm-hmm. again, a movie,
yeah.
I need there to be substance to it. And my biggest problem with this movie is it's... there's not a lot of substance. It's okay. Now we're going to move on to the next one just because we're going to move on to the next one. And then they do, and they move on, and that's it. They've moved on. That's it.
Yeah.
I think that individually they're very interesting. I think the Greek one with the centaurs is very cool. I think that the one at the end is amazing. It's not Greek, is it? Whatever it is, John, you tell me. But the centaurs is great. But the one at the end is amazing with Satan and all that, and then Ave Maria. Like, those are really awesome moments. Obviously, the Sorcerer's Apprentice is iconic. Like, there's no denying that. I mean, that's Mickey Mouse's biggest role. However, that to me, that's just what they are, though. It's a bunch mm-hmm. of different short, random things. It's hard for me to get on board. I gave this 2.5 stars. If it wasn't a movie and it was just like, hey, like, we're going to play a game or like sit down and talk to each other and put this on and it just be the music with the images, that's a great thing. Like, I'm all about that. Like, you know, but as a movie, I have a hard time knowing what to do with it. It's an amazing idea. It's very well executed. But I don't know what to do with it. I don't know what to do with it.
So. Yeah, I get that. And A lot of it comes from, and that's kind of the reason why it exists in the first place, in my opinion, because people don't know what to do with it, because mm-hmm. people don't know what to do with classical music. Mm-hmm. This is just a classical this is an orchestra concert. Mm-hmm. That is what this is. It's an orchestra concert set to images, with images mm-hmm. set to the music, right? And that's exactly what Disney was setting out to do. Disney wasn't out here to make a through line through this all. And you can kind of tell when you look at the pieces that are chosen for the film. Mm-hmm. But Disney is creating a concert to introduce children and the general public to music, which a lot of the time people either need to seek out or have a lot of money to go witness. Mm-hmm. And that's what's so beautiful about this film is that we're sitting there at the beginning and we have Deems Taylor kind of introducing everything. Mm-hmm. And he's telling you exactly this, that this is an experience. It's different than what you're used to. What we're doing is we took these animators who don't know anything about music. We gave them these pieces of music that are, these are pretty iconic pieces of music.
Yeah,
there's nothing, sure. Nothing's coming out of left field. Even when they redid it again in 2000, like, again, they kept with fairly iconic pieces of music. Personally, I think the music choices in 2000 are actually better than this overall, because it kind of, rather than focusing on different eras, it focuses on different genres. Mm-hmm. But what we have now is Deems Taylor explaining exactly what this is. And from the first notes of Toccata and Fugue in D minor, mm-hmm. and following Deems Taylor's explanation of it, and we get that emphasis on the different parts of the orchestra performing, and then we slowly transition into the animation, mm-hmm. and it's very subtle animation at first, just like, oh, here's like fleeting colors that are moving to the music and stuff like that. And as we transition more and more until we get to that climax of Night on Bald Mountain and Ave Maria, where it's a very definite story being told, it's that progress that just really reels in an audience in a way which sitting at in a concert hall without images can be very difficult for people to engage with.
Well, and you've seen, though, how a lot of musicians have kind of taken on the Fantasia approach, mm-hmm. whether that be, and whether you want to say it's the approach, but Pink Floyd, one of my favorite bands of all time, everything they're doing has massive amounts of visuals while the music is going on. They have a song, Echoes, that's 23 minutes and 28 seconds long. It goes on and on and on. There's, I think, maybe 20 lines of lyrics in the entire thing, and it's 23 minutes, 28 seconds long. But this is a rock band. I mean, this is the band mm-hmm. that does, you know, The Happiest Days of Our Lives, Another Brick in the Wall, like regular money, like regular mm-hmm. rock songs. But when they decide that live they're going to play that or Shine On You Crazy Diamond or something like that, they need to have the visuals to go with it, and they knew that. And I mm-hmm. think that that's something that actually really elevates a lot nowadays. Like Explosions in the Sky, if you've ever seen Explosions in the Sky live, they are literally Fantasia. Like that is mm-hmm. what it is. Explosion in the Sky goes up there. They play for a really long, loud time. And there is a screen behind them that is flashing colors and images and whatever. It's awesome. It's awesome. So like I 100% agree with you on the importance of this movie and how groundbreaking it was and how it, you know, it did bring this music to people who maybe wouldn't have paid attention to it otherwise, and how it was able to move through time and build up. I mean, this obviously influenced John Williams. I told you to write down the name of the song because I couldn't pay attention to the name of the song, but the one is literally the score from Jaws. It is the opening score from Jaws. It is spot on 100% the opening score from Jaws. And, but it shows how influential all of these things can be. Mm-hmm. I say all those nice things and I just keep going back, but it's not really a movie. It's not, like, and I will say this, the one thing that really ages poorly in this are those cuts in between. The guy talking, for as iconic as his voice is so funny to me, like what was important in 1940. Mm-hmm. So I always think there's this movie, The Bad Seed. I don't know if anybody's ever seen it, about like a little girl who like pretty much just murders people. And at the end, it shows all the people alive because it was made in like the 40s or 50s. the thing was, at the time, you had to show that, like, no, the little girl wasn't actually murdering people. Right. Like, it was all a movie. It's okay. And I think it's funny how in 1940, it was like, yo, I'm going to tell you about this because you need to understand. Like, you wouldn't be able to figure out. Now I'm like, just play the music and show the images. Like, let's go. Like, what was it? Arcade Fire, when they released their album Reflector, they literally released it over the course of, and you should know them, John, they're Canadian, eh? They have their, what, that whole album is, I think, 50 minutes, 60 minutes long, and it plays over an entire Brazilian film. Mm-hmm. And like, there's no sound. It's the whole Dark Side of Oz thing. Like, these are really great ideas. That just ages very, very, very poorly. And like watching them walk up and kind of like do it, I get it at the beginning, but like I don't need to like see what they're doing, you know, in between every song. Like I don't really care that the violinist is prepping his violin.
But that is what a live concert's like, right? Yes, there are times when we'll transition without the conductor acknowledging anything, mm-hmm. and things like that. But there are specific pieces of music with specific things that are supposed to be said before they are performed.
That is true. That is true.
That the composer has put forward. And I actually really appreciate that Disney kind of treats it that way because, yeah, we have Dean Taylor, and I mean, how much better would this have been if it was Stokowski himself narrating?
Yes.
Yeah, it would have been infinitely better. But we also still get fantastic things like Dean Taylor saying the Nutcracker isn't performed that often.
That made me laugh so hard because I'm like, holy shit, that's right. This is 81 years old.
Yeah.
It's 81 years old. Now the Nutcracker is one of the most popular things, probably absolutely. The most popular musical of all time.
Yeah, it's a ballet that's performed literally every year in countless cities around the world.
Yeah.
And to think that in 1940, it wasn't that. And like,
nobody knew what it was.
That's what's crazy. Really so great about this. And like, obviously, when we're talking about like, The Sorcerer's Apprentice has become this iconic piece of Disney animation, despite the fact that, I mean, no one really remembers Ka aside from this piece.
Yeah.
And it's so much so that in the 2000 film, they did it again. They just showed it again. And as a kid, when I went to Disneyland for the first time, the most excited person I was to see was Sorcerer Mickey. And I was like, yes, Fantasia, this is fantastic. And then we don't get some of these great, there's a lot of times where we don't really get great narration. Obviously, Dean Taylor does not go into like the riot, the Rite of Spring caused, or the fact that it is literally one of the most important pieces in all of music history because it changed us from the Romantic era to the modern era. And it really showed us how rhythm impacts. And like, we don't even get him, and he doesn't really go into the actual, what the actual piece is about. He kind of like lays it down about how it's you know, about these rituals. He doesn't mention that it's a ritual sacrifice of a virgin.
It's probably better considering like this is aimed probably. At children, but you know,
probably. And then, but then we also get this explanation of what we're seeing while the pastoral plays. And trust me, Beethoven 6th, not my favorite Beethoven piece. In fact, it's one of my least favorite Beethoven piece. And seeing it in this movie always makes me go, why was that the Beethoven piece they decided to keep? But it's still interesting. Like you said, it's cool. It's an interesting story, despite the racist depictions in it that were at the time. And then
which one is this?
That's the Greek one. That's the Greek one.
Oh, okay. Got it.
Yes, with the culturally insensitive ones. But then you also get Dance of the Hours, which has these ostriches dancing who are like these stereotypical ballerina bodies, and then they're replaced with the hippos, who are like the exact opposite of that stereotypical body, and it's like so body positive. And then we have the crocodiles, who are these menacing creatures who come in and join in the dance and work together. And it's all this idea of like appearances aren't or can be deceiving, and like you shouldn't judge someone just by what they look like. And then we have Night on Bald Mountain and Deems Taylor's explanation of like the animation between it. And like what the background of the story is. First off, no one will ever tell you Mussorgsky is the greatest Russian composer of all time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. He did, though. Deems Taylor did.
He did. Deems Taylor did. But no one else will. And like Night on Bald Mountain is a piece that really influenced me as a kid. And I've written a paper on Night on Bald Mountain. mm-hmm. for university.
Oh, shit.
And compared it to the original Gogol story that it's based off of. So it means a lot for me to see this type of music here and its interpretation. Yeah, Dean Taylor doesn't really kind of like hoes and hums the details in a lot of his interactions, but I think it's really important because there are a lot of things you're going to be seeing in these, especially in like the Rite of Spring, when you go from the Big Bang to the extinction of the dinosaurs, where as a kid, you're just not going to get that. And you're not going to get how absolutely incredible it is to see this piece of this iconic piece of music that birthed modern music, showing the birth of the universe.
Yeah.
And how important that is.
Yeah, and apologies for sneezing into the microphone. I tried to mute it. And apologies for saying shit. I was trying to look up the music list from this. And when I did it, it started blasting music in my ears. And I was like, oh, my God, I'm going to go deaf. So I just had a bad, like, minute and a half of John speaking. No offense to John. It was everything else going on around it. But, no, I do agree with you. Like, there are very cool concepts in this. Very cool. I do think another thing, though, that knocks it is that it's 2 hours and 6 minutes long.
It is a little long.
And I go back to, if you said, Phil, let's watch this 15-minute one about, you know, pretty much the birth of civilization and the end of the dinosaurs, I'd be like, cool. And I'd watch it. And I'd be like, that was pretty sweet. Cool.
Yeah.
But having to watch over and over, like, it just keeps going. And I'm like, oh, my God. Like, when is this going to end? And the answer is, in 2 hours and 6 minutes. Like, that is a very long. And then, you know, the next Fantasia was 70 minutes long. It's like they knew.
Yes.
If you're making this type of movie, you cannot make it super long. This is 7 minutes longer than The Last Picture Show. That's pretty wild. I mean, The Last Picture Show, we just talked about it with like the themes and everything going on. I'm not saying that Fantasia doesn't pack a lot in, but did it need to be 7 minutes longer than The Last Picture Show? No. So I guess that's where, like, I agree with you that a lot of this is really interesting, but they save so many of the really interesting ones for the back half. And by that point, I'm like, let's go. Like, when is it happening? Like, it just takes
my biggest criticism of this is actually like the inclusion of Beethoven 6, because it's just 22 minutes long. And you finish the first act with the Rite of Spring, which is this very bombastic piece, and I understand following it up with the pastoral, but following it up with a 20-minute pastoral just drags it out a lot. And that's honestly where the film loses me a little bit, is in that section. Because again, not a big Beethoven 6 fan. Why didn't you do like Beethoven 7, which is this iconic bombastic piece of music? And then I get where they're doing it. But like I said, we're jumping all across time with these pieces, right? We open with a Bach piece, which is a Baroque piece. And then we have a few romantic pieces in there with the Nutcracker Suite and Sorcerer's Apprentice, to a modern piece in the Rite of Spring. And then we go back to an actual classical era piece with Beethoven, and then we finish it off with more romantic stuff. And it almost seems like it was this great idea, and obviously like they worked with the Philadelphia Orchestra and Stokowski to create it, but it almost felt like they were like, let's give this snippet of everything rather than making a cohesive concert, because you would never see a concert constructed the way that this film is constructed.
Well, yeah, it's almost like they wanted to, how could they... They were trying to figure out with themselves, how can we make this accessible to a little bit of everybody? And they have to know. I mean, you have to think again. In 1940, they're stating that the Nutcracker isn't that popular. Now they can make this whole movie with just the Nutcracker. Like, they can just make it with all of that. So you have to think, like, what we're looking – like, back then, they're probably looking at this as, like, whoever's going to watch this ain't going to know what the hell is going on anyway in terms of what the music – they're going to be pumped that they're listening to the music. They're not going to realize all these intricacies. And I'll be honest with you, I don't notice these intricacies. You do, because you're so big into it, but I don't notice that. And so, like, for me, I think it's interesting I wish that there was more explanation. If they were going to do explanation, why did they decide to pick the certain ones that they picked? Like, what? Mm-hmm. I would love to know the thought process behind that more than I want to hear Deems Taylor say whatever it is Deems Taylor says. Like, I wish that there was more into, like, this is why we chose this one to come before this one, and now we'll give you hope. Like, I like at the end when they say why they play Bald Mountain and Ave Maria together. I think that's a really great idea, and I'm like, awesome. Like, I can't wait to see how this is going to play out. Not for nothing, that to me, obviously Sorcerer's Apprentice, because it's got Mickey Mouse, that one is like the best, and I think the best looking, and that villain on top is so iconic. I mean, that is a massive thing, and it's funny because that's always in like all like the Disney shows and stuff, and nobody ever says like, oh, that's Satan, by the way. I don't. That's the big guy right there. Nobody ever says that. But that's what they're showing, and in this one we hear about that. But I love the fact that Ave Maria comes in at the end, almost as like a yep, nope, we're back. It's a beautiful design, and that was one where I was like, all right, like I wish the whole thing would have just been this. Like they should have just made a 55-minute movie and it all be that thing, and like the ride, like you know the. I keep wanting to say the birth and death of the day because of freaking explosions in the sky, but you know what I mean. Right.
Yes. Well, I mean. Personally, my favorite segment of this is always going to be the Rite of Spring. I mean, Igor Stravinsky is one of the greatest Russian composers of all time. And I understand them not saying that back in 1940. This piece was 28 years old and caused a riot when it was first aired. And that's crazy. That was to do with like the music. It was a totally different take on music. And the choreography, if you ever have a chance, just YouTube the Joffrey choreography for this musical or for this ballet story, and like you will see, you'll understand why in 1912 they were rioting because of this film or because of this ballet. It's interesting. It's different. It's completely different. And but the moment that really gets me in this film is actually that fight between the Tyrannosaurus Rex and the Stegosaurus.
Yeah.
It's so strong. It's so impactful. Just like when the tail falls down.
Yeah, I agree.
And it gets back up and it falls down again. And just like the bassoon opening to Rite of Spring always gets me. And it's such a phenomenal piece. And we're talking about like influences on John Williams. Listen to the Rite of Spring and then go listen to the music from A New Hope.
Okay.
Because it's almost identical.
That's great. Yeah, he definitely is. I mean, it makes sense. He's a composer. It makes sense that he's influenced.
You quote things when you compose.
Yeah. It's just funny because I'm like, wow. You know, I'm like listening, like as I'm listening to him, I'm like, holy shit, this is Jaws. And you're right, A New Hope. I'll have to go listen and figure that out.
Yeah, it's just phenomenal. And like I said, as someone who studied music, having something that's so easily accessible to children and to be able to share music like this with people who wouldn't normally engage with it is just so important to me.
Yeah. Well, I tried to engage with it. I did my best. I did my best. It's just, you know, it is. It's a tough thing, man. It's a tough thing. Is this going to stay as high up as
probably? Honestly, okay. Like it really excites me every time I watch this movie.
Okay. All right. I hear you. I hear you. It doesn't do it for me, but hey, that's why it's movies, and that's why we all have our own taste, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's okay. We're going to talk about more films with less plot further on in our lists.
Which what are we talking about here?
Oh, we have a man with a movie camera.
I knew man with a movie camera. Yeah. I knew that one was coming. That's a good point. So, yeah, not surprised by that one. But okay, we're not going to keep counting down our 100 movies next week. We're going to take a little break from that because next week will be our last podcast of 2021. So since John and I are both on pace, John, are you on pace to hit 365 movies or not?
I sure am.
Yeah. What are you at right now?
I think after today, I think I have six more. before I get there?
I'm going to look up J. Millsap. I'm at it. My letterbox says 356, but then when you look at the amount of movies I've actually watched, it's 358. So I don't know why they don't count movies that you've watched more than once.
I'm at 361 right now for the year. So I only need
okay. Yeah. See, yours says 345, even though you're actually at 361. Yeah. So it doesn't count movies if you watch them more than once. But anyway, since we're both on pace to do that, we're going to do something a little bit different and kind of talk about, we're going to do a little 2021 year end podcast. We're going to talk about our best five first watches. Doesn't matter what year they came out, just a movie that we saw for the first time this year. The most disappointing movie we watched this year. The biggest pleasant surprise we watched this year. A movie that just wasn't as good as we remembered. A movie that was way better than we remembered. The worst movie that we watched this year, which will be different than most disappointing, because those are two different things.
Yes.
The worst movie of 2021 and our top five movies of 2021. Keeping in mind that Oscar movies still aren't really out where either one of us are. So those top movies of 2021 are really only going to be the ones that we've seen in 2021. And there's a very good chance I'm not going to see movies like Licorice Pizza and West Side Story and all that. And there's a good chance that some of those will pop in there. I'm going to try to watch at least The Power of the Dog before we hop on and see if that would jump above what I currently have as my number five, which is The French Dispatch. Not to spoil, but I want to see if that happens. Cause as I talked about The French Dispatch, I'm not huge on The French Dispatch. So Gotta see kind of what happens here. But that's what we're going to be doing next week. So if you're going to be following along, maybe you could do it a little bit yourself, too, and think about where you're at there. Anyway, though, John, always good. This was number 55. This is a weird podcast for a lot of people. Weird podcast for a lot of people. But, yeah, that's it. We will we'll be back next week. We don't know exactly what date or time yet, but we'll talk about it. And we'll you know, just keep an eye out for your messages on the old whatever you follow us on. And we'll see you later.
Bye, everyone.